The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, some of you may know Psalm 23 and may have realised a critical word was left out of that psalm. Did anyone... It's just a typing error. The last word was accidentally left off. I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Now, why do you think my mates who, when I became a Christian, chose not to become a Christian and told me it was a passing psychological phase or illness, why do you think they go to ashrams? Why do you think at times they go to courses of medication? Why do they go to courses on meditation? Why do they take medication? Some of it's self-given, self-prescribed, that is, alcohol, etc., is for many people a form of medication they take when life gets stressful. Because in the end, there is, in our remarkably wealthy and safe society, a very obvious lack of peace. And so people do all sorts of things. They go to beautiful, quiet ashrams in beautiful parts of the countryside. They try to learn to meditate in order to still the voices and the noise in their head. And they take various substances. About a year and a bit ago, I was struck by a man I'd met in the city, a very successful man, had his own company, was making large sums of money. He had it all. And yet he said to me, Ian, I just want some peace. And I was surprised about that because it wasn't a thing that I had ever asked myself in quite that way. But one of the strange things about our society is when the Australian Bureau of Statistics came out with some research again fairly recently, you may know that they said that the most frequently experienced mental illness or psychological problem in Australia is anxiety. Anxiety often linked with depression, because if you are anxious long enough, it will often develop into depression as well. And yet, as you probably know, Australia is probably the country where, if you looked at it objectively, we should be the least anxious. I mean, as I understand it, our economy is in a better state than England's, America's, most. We've got arguably one of the best health systems. I mean, if you watch current affairs shows, they'll have horror stories when people fall through the cracks, but fundamentally, this is a great place to get sick. Unlike, say, America. I can give you all sorts of stories of people with no money at all who had hundreds of thousands of dollars of medical stuff thrown at them when they got sick. This is a great place to get sick. We should really be a very peaceful culture, peace-filled culture, and yet we are, objectively speaking, a very anxious culture seeking peace. Here's a question that you'll probably know the answer to, and if you don't, you can ask friends and you can stump them. There's 66 books in the Bible. The book of Psalms, where this comes from, is part of the Bible. It's the Hebrew, it's the Old Testament book of songs and poems. Do you know what is the most frequently given command? You probably do, or at least some of you will know. What is the most frequently given command in the 66 books in the Bible? What do you think is the thing that God most often says, all the way from Genesis, the first book, all the way through to the last book in Revelation? This command is given again and again, 366 times. That's one for every day of the year, including the leap year. Anyone know what the command is? You probably do, but you're not wanting to show off. The command, the most frequently given command in the Bible, overwhelmingly, is the command, do not be afraid, or fear not. Now, people who don't know the God of the Bible may think, actually, the Bible wants to keep you fearful, so you'll keep paying your money at church, so the poor can keep being ripped off by the rich, etc., etc. But one of the things that the Bible actually says again, that it does not want people to be fearful. It actually says there are things you should be frightened of, but the general experience of life, God is saying, don't be afraid, don't be afraid, and almost always attaches a reason to it. It's not just that he's anti-fear for the sake of being anti-fear. He actually argues when you get to know him, you don't need to be fearful or anxious. The flip side of that in the Bible's terms is that you may enjoy peace. So there in the outline, you've got a statement, at least part of a statement from Jesus. John's Gospel, one of the four Gospels or biographies of Jesus, chapter 16. It's the night before Jesus dies, and he's been outlining to his disciples that as he is to be crucified and to suffer unfairly, so will they. And he says, they hated me without a cause, so they will hate you without a cause. Now, sometimes Christians are hated with a very just cause. I'm not just saying every time Christians get a hard time, they don't deserve it, but an enormous amount of what they get, Jesus says, and I think my experience would indicate this is the case, they don't deserve. But Jesus is outlining the fact that they will have trouble. Listen to what he says to his disciples the night before he gets put to death. I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble. So Jesus is really saying you will have both things at the one time. You'll have trouble. But he says, in me you can also have peace in the midst of it. See, I think what we try to do when it comes to removing the things that cause anxiety and the troublous when we're seeking peace is we try to set up a thing where all the things that make us fearful are removed. Now, occasionally we try to do it technologically. So we launch a ship, which for many years I didn't believe they actually said this, but then I read a book that footnoted it and said it was true, that this ship, not even God could sink it. In fact, the ship that launched the Titanic, the ship before that, Captain Smith, who was the captain of the Titanic on its one short, tragic journey, said the days of ships sinking are over. Sometimes we build technological things we think that will keep us safe. Sometimes we try to use geography to keep us safe. We build ashrams or palaces or castles high up in the mountains, in the biggest mountains, in Tibet, thinking, for example, that will cause us to be peaceful, and then the next door neighbours come through and conquer Tibet. Sometimes we try to build up peace and security by education. We're always trying to work out ways to lock out danger. High on mountains, or if you go to Cappadocia in Turkey, they actually dug castles into the rock under the villages. So one great Greek traveller went through there about 200 years before Jesus and was puzzled by the fact that in Cappadocia there were no castles or places of defence. And he couldn't work out how these people kept themselves safe. Well, they didn't tell him that the reason was because they dug their castles into the sandstone. It's not sandstone, but it looks like sandstone. We're always trying to build in safe places where we won't be troubled. They never work. They're always overwhelmed. And then in the world of trouble and fear, Psalm 23 is, without a doubt, the most favourite chapter of the Old Testament, whether you're Jewish or Christian. Psalm 23 is the one people have loved generation after generation. Why? Well, because it exudes an extraordinary sense of peace and confidence while it acknowledges the fact that life is very dangerous. So he's going to speak of himself like a sheep, which we'll come to in a second. And he speaks about the sheep having to go through the valley of the shadow of death, which is the place sheep hate going through. And in verse 5, he speaks about the presence of enemies. So it's not as if he's saying, I've discovered peace where there are no enemies near me and there are no scary stuff. It's not it at all. The power of this psalm is that the psalmist, the guy who writes this, has discovered a way to know peace even when life remains dangerous and always deadly. It is the favourite psalm. Now, as you may have noticed as it was read to you, what the writer does is he parallels himself with an animal and with God with a particular relationship these animals have with a particular human. The animal he pictures himself is as a sheep. And one of the things, when I became a Christian, I discovered some things in the Bible I like, some things in the Bible I don't like. I like the fact that the Bible always pictures death as an enemy. It never pretends that death is a friend. It speaks about how death gets overwhelmed and gets conquered, but it never pretends death. So even the death of my father, who was in his late 70s and had ongoing Parkinson's disease, and he died full of faith in Jesus, I take it he is with God now. Nonetheless, his death is still not a good thing. I would much prefer it if he hadn't died. Death is still an enemy in human relationships. And one of the sad things about our culture is we keep trying to pretend that death's okay. So the most frequently played song at funerals in England, non-church funerals, is Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. I mean, that's pathetic, really. that's the song people want to have. Let's just pretend that something horrible hasn't happened. Let's just pretend that we can just look on the bright side. Although, I won't go into that song because it's an interesting song. So this psalm is worthwhile looking at because the writer pictures himself as a sheep. Now, yeah, I don't know what you think about sheep. I don't like sheep. I think they're pathetic animals. They're scary. In fact, when I was a little, long before I became a Christian, I used to enjoy scaring them when I drove to the country because they can be sitting under a tree. You can be driving past at about 90 miles an hour and there's a fence and all sorts of things. They're sitting under a tree and running. If you yell out of the car going right past them, they will jump up and run away. I mean, brilliant. Geniuses. And all sorts of crazy things that sheep do. But they do taste nice. But the problem for the sheep is this. In the Middle East, when this psalm was written, and in the time it was written, there were not just humans who liked eating sheep, but there were lions. The Palestinian lion only became extinct in the 20th century. There's lions, there's bears, and there's packs of wolves in the Middle East at this time. Now, all those things are rather keen on a leg of lamb. So if you're a sheep in the Middle East, when this psalm was written, you know, about 1,000 years before Jesus, 3,000 years ago, you better have a shepherd. A sheep without a shepherd in the Middle East, unlike a sheep in a paddock in Australia, which is a very good chance to be okay, because we don't have any predatory animals. They may get their eyes plucked out by crows sometimes, rarely, but sometimes. If you're a sheep without a shepherd, you're a nearly extinct sheep. So when a sheep wanders off, as they sometimes do from the shepherd, they normally enjoy it until the sun begins to set, and then they get a bit panicky. But so he says, I'm like a sheep and God is the shepherd. So look at the first five words are the very key to peace. The Lord is my shepherd. So here's a guy who's picturing himself like a sheep. And he's kind of in the local pub with the other sheep. And he's bragging about his shepherd. He's saying, boy, have I got a great shepherd. And he's saying, you know, because the Lord's my shepherd, here's a few logical consequences that come. Now, who would like to think of themselves as a sheep? I mean, I'd rather be a duck than a sheep, frankly. I mean, a duck at least can fly and they can swim on the water, under the water. Sheep, what can they do? Eat and get eaten, basically. And they're fearful. They're very anxious. In fact, I've spent a bit of time with the guy who used to be the dean of the vet faculty at Sydney University. Grew up on a sheep farm, became the head of the vet faculty at Sydney, and then went back to his sheep farm. He's had a go at me a few times for suggesting that sheep are stupid. He said, Ian, the problem for sheep is not that they're stupid. The problem sheep has is that they're anxious and they don't know who to trust. So they'll often trust the wrong person. That's the fundamental mark of looking after sheep. They need a lot of care. They're fearful and they're anxious and they trust the wrong person. But this guy says, the Lord is my shepherd. He says, he leads me, he guides me, leads me in green pastures. He's picturing himself as a sheep. What sort of loser pictures himself as a sheep? Well, we don't have much time to look at the life of David, but the guy who wrote it, David, King David, is an alpha male with far too much testosterone. He was good-looking, handsome, intellectually sharp, was a great warrior, a great fighter, the classic fight with Goliath, etc., and we've actually dug up now evidence of that, exactly that family name, the Goliaths, in the Philistines. It's a nice little bit of background evidence we've picked up about the accuracy of the sort of story of the Bible. That's another issue. But David he became king, led armies, led guerrilla warfare, was at times hunted down by powerful men with armies. You know, this guy, if anyone is a unscaredy-cat sort of guy, this is not a guy with a bad self-esteem. This is a guy who's massively strong and confident, and yet maybe it's because he is this. He's strong enough to admit that he's weak. Often you need to be a very strong, confident person to acknowledge ignorance. So there's a beautiful story, true story, it was in an allegedly good biography, of Einstein, when he was already quite a well-known physicist. I think he'd already won some of his great awards. A young physicist came in with a new idea and was writing some of the maths on the board, and Einstein said to him, please go slowly with the maths with me. Don't go too fast. And he thinks, are you kidding me? Now, my guess is if you reversed the role, if the great Einstein had come in and was showing the young man something and was going too fast, the young man probably wouldn't have said, please go slowly with me. The young man would have bluffed. Do you not think he would have pretended that he could stay with the great Einstein? He wouldn't. But if you're the great Einstein, you can say, whoa, 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 slow down. And sometimes it's only the really powerful who can acknowledge the fragility of what it is to be human. You are very fragile. You could die in a moment. There are little things so small we can't even see and they can kill you. I mean, we are enormously powerful as humans and at the same time remarkably weak and vulnerable. King David is willing to admit the fact that he needs a shepherd. And he says, I've got a brilliant one. And this is the key to peace in a troubled world. Not finding a place where all the fears and possible dangers are gone, but he says the secret of peace is finding this relationship. So you can see in the outline there's one serious relationship followed by three logical outcomes. We don't have half enough time to deal with it in the depth. It'd be fun to do it. But so he says, this is the relationship. And just see if you know this, if you can say this. The Lord is my shepherd. I don't actually know which word to emphasize. You probably wouldn't emphasize the word the. Lord. That when you see Lord in capital letters, I think it's in capitals there. The Lord, yes. That is the indication in the English that it's the word Yahweh, it's the Hebrew personal name for God. It's a bit like you can know me as Mr. Powell, you can know me as lots of things, or you can know me as Ian. And if you call me Ian, it's indicative of some level of probable friendship. Well, God gives his first name to Moses, Yahweh. And he's saying, Yahweh is my shepherd. This is the God who rescues Israel from Egypt. This is the God who before that had created the heavens and the earth. This is the God who says he will judge us all. This is the God who will bring the whole universe, the whole cosmos to an end. The Bible is well aware of the vastness of the cosmos. Some modern people, without bothering to study but quick to make a comment, will pretend that, you know, these fools back in the Bible, they didn't realize how big the world. No. Psalm 8. King David will speak about the vastness of the universe. Now, he couldn't put the same numbers on it we put on it, but then in 100 years' time, those numbers would look silly anyhow. He knew how big this God was. Is he saying, the Lord is my shepherd? Is that what he's getting excited about? The person? He's saying, this one of great power, this God who makes promises and keeps them. Or is he saying, the Lord is my shepherd? Is that where the stress is? It's this person, and I'm in this relationship. Because a shepherd is entirely committed. The shepherd lived with the sheep, slept out in the open with the sheep. And the shepherd would risk his life, if he was a good shepherd, to protect the sheep. A bad shepherd wouldn't. If you had a good shepherd and you were a sheep, you had a good life. Because they tended not to keep sheep for eating. They very rarely ate the sheep. They kept the sheep for the wool and the milk. They made cheese and other things like that out of it. You can still buy at expensive delicatessens, sheep cheese. So, or it's the Lord is my shepherd, the Lord is my shepherd, or is it the Lord is my shepherd? It's that, I want to suggest to you, it's the ability to say, my shepherd is the essence of peace in a troubled world. To say that there's actually a relationship. He's not just the shepherd in theory, but he's my shepherd. So David is saying, I'm his sheep. He is my shepherd. So he's saying, I will therefore go where the shepherd says to go. When he says we're going to Bethlehem to eat, I'll go with him. When he says we're going down to Capernaum now, I'll go there. And so the shepherd leads the sheep. He says there's three logical conclusions. And I've underlined for you the three words shall there in the English. What he's basically saying is that the backbone, the essential idea is there. The Lord is my shepherd, which King David says. Three therefores, outcomes. I shall not want, in verse 1. Verse 4, I shall fear no evil. Verse 6, I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Three logical outcomes that come out of this relationship. If you're able to say with any genuineness, the Lord is my shepherd, these three wonderfully energizing confidences are yours. Just briefly. The first one is the all-inclusive one. The Lord is my shepherd, therefore what? I shall not want. This is a slightly old-fashioned use of the word want. You might know that most parents endeavour to teach their children the difference between needs and wants. I need a Mercedes-Benz. No, you want a Mercedes-Benz. I need a bigger house. No, you want a bigger house. Whatever. What he's saying here is that there is nothing that I will not be in want. I will not be in need. So he's saying insufficiency is never the problem. So when I became a Christian when I was 19, with absolutely no conception of God being my shepherd at all, not interested in that, since then, God has been the one who's committed to meet my needs. Have I always had what I want? No. But I can say with the psalm, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. That is, I shall not be in need of anything. You might like to come back to this in the question time, but here's how I worked out what I know what Ian Powell needs. The way that I work out what Ian Powell needs is by what the shepherd gives me. You might think that's cheating, isn't it? No. It's just, I understand now that the shepherd, and Jesus says this is him, isn't it? You know, Jesus says, this is one of the reasons I tried to kill him. In John chapter 10, Jesus says, I am the good shepherd. And at the end of that chapter, you'll find that his fellow Jews are trying to kill him. Why? Because we all know who the shepherd is. The shepherd is God. Jesus says, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. With that sort of love and commitment, I understand God will meet all my needs. There is nothing that I will need that he will go, nah, you can't have it. If he's willing to give his son, it's the logic of Romans 8. If God has given us his son, will he not also with him give us all things? So the first thing is, all our needs are met. Now, of course, if you work in the advertising industry, and that's a perfectly legitimate industry to work in, part of the advertising industry, and it's worthwhile knowing this if you're an Australian, there are billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars spent every year researching you, me, us, and working out how to make us have a sense of need for things that we don't need. It actually started in America when they began to get machinery so much that they could make much more soap than they needed. Suddenly you had to convince people why they needed to buy more soap than they could possibly need. And you need to convince people to use more soap than they would have ever needed in the past. And it's this need to keep us wanting stuff that we don't, you know, we've got enough. We've got enough clothes, we've got enough toys, we've got enough cars, but we need more. And then we need a bigger house to keep all our stuff in. So, you know, the statistics in Australia now is houses are getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger with less and less people in them. Because we need all this space to put all our junk in. If you know the shepherd, your needs are met. Verse 4. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. Now, basically, for a sheep, their nightmare is a shadowy valley. Because what do they know deep in their DNA lurks in shadows? Bears, wolves, lions, and humans. Sheep will not sleep near shadows. Sheep will only lie down. If you look at sheep, most of the time when you see them, they're standing up. They only lie down in open areas where they can see what's happening. They hate valleys of shadows, of death. This is like a sheep's nightmare. And he says, though I have to go through the worst sort of nightmare, I will fear no evil. Nothing ultimately destructive will happen to me. Things will hurt, things will scare me perhaps, but King David knows that though he will walk through terrors, nothing ultimately evil and destructive of him as a person will happen. Things will make him cry. If you look at the life of David, even as an old man, he went through horrors. One of his sons raped one of his daughters. And this, I mean, who could think of living through that? As an old man, he got chased again by a person who wanted to be king, and he was back living in caves as an old man. He says, in the end, I'll fear no evil. Justin Martyr, one of the early Christians, when the Christians were being martyred, said this to the Roman authorities. You can kill us, but you cannot harm us. Must have irritated them. And the Romans did. They killed many, many children, women and men of the early Christian church for the first 300 years off and on. But he's right. You can kill us, and that's going to hurt, but you can't harm us. And lastly, he says, I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. One of the marks of biblical religion, which is in absolute contrast to Buddhism, to the understandings of reincarnation in Hinduism, and to Islam, is the absolute confidence with which a Christian, a person who knows the shepherd, can confront death. Because we know, David says, I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. How can he have that confidence? Is David saying, I've been such a good person, I will enter nirvana after this? He's not. David was a murderer. David was an adulterer. And David knew he was. David knew he'd done horrendous things. that he repented of in tears and horror. David knew he didn't deserve to dwell in the house of the Lord forever. David knew the peculiarity of what the Bible says about God, which is this, and this is unlike any other system of belief. You don't go to heaven because you're good. You know that, probably. You go to heaven because he's good. Jesus dies to buy pardon and peace for people like David. So David can say, when I look at the ultimate terror, the terror that is so frightening we don't even talk about it, that we go to, in the West, anyway, we have coffins, and what do we do with them? We cover them with flowers so you can barely see it's a coffin. We have all these expressions rather than saying he died. We're terrified of death. You know, one of the ways you can tell how frightened we are of death? We pretend we're not frightened of it. It's a classic denial. So yeah, there's all these studies that indicate this. You may have heard speeches like this. Did you know that in Australia, and it's true in America too, people are more frightened of public speaking than they are of dying? Oh, really? This is because they've ticked that in order? That is such self-evident rubbish. So if I get a bit frightened of speaking today, and I say, I can't do it. I can't speak. These people look too intelligent. They make me nervous. I can't do it. I'm frightened. If Ken pulls out a gun and says, speak or I'll blow your brains, I go, no, I'm more frightened of public speaking than I am of being having my... I mean, it's such self-evident rubbish. But the very fact that it is repeatedly comes up in surveys is indication of the fact we can't face how frightened we are of death. David can look at death and say, I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. And it's because he knows the shepherd. The secret of peace in the Bible is not to escape from the things that trouble you, because you never will this side of death, but it's to know a person who will oversee and guard you and guide you. I'm nervous about saying that for this reason. One of the things I used to say about Christianity before I became a Christian was, Christians just invented religion to make themselves feel safe in a dangerous world. And here's the Bible saying, you are safe in a dangerous world. But it's not that Christians have invented it. It's the logical working out of the fact, if the God of the universe and I have entered a relationship and he loves me enough to die for me, he will oversee all things for good. Now, I'm going to stop there so there's time for questions. Who would like to start? Or I can just keep talking if you like. But that would be better if there were questions. Any queries or statements, disagreements, whatever you'd like to do. It may well be that I will die horribly. One of my great fears would be that I go caving, which I've only done twice, and I did it just to deal with my fears, really, and suddenly the ground moves and I get stuck in the earth like Winnie the Pooh gets stuck in the hole. And I die in exactly the way I don't want to die, that you end up being led, is it 1984, into room 101, where that thing which you fear most is there. It may well be that I die of starvation. As you rightly say, many Christians have died in countries in some of the great famines in Ethiopia. And that will be okay. In the end, David dies. Everyone dies. It's a question of what. But if in the end I die in that way, I've had things happen in my life. I've gone through my own valley of the shadow of death, where terrible things happen that didn't need to happen. But in the end, I know God will be with me in the middle of them. Yes, this is not a recipe for, you know, now life will go as I want it. But it's just saying that in the middle of the valley of the shadow of death, which is for sheep the nightmare scenario, he says, why will he fear no evil? For you are with me. So I die in the presence of God. Not happy with that? What the ordinary view of religion that humans have is that it is the job of the God, whoever is believed in, to look after me and to make my family successful. If I'm a man, to make my wife fruitful, to make my camels fruitful, to make the crops grow. And there's a general feeling that in religion, and people have this even if they're not religious, if they think they've been reasonably good people and bad things happen, they'll often get angry at God. They may never talk about God. So once or twice we had a terrible thing in England years ago, I think it was in England, where some of the young hoodlums began to riot, and in the end a whole lot of people died in this stadium because the stadium collapsed. What was the heading on the front of the Daily Telegraph? Oh God, why? Well, you know why, because drunken idiots played and people hadn't, and engineers hadn't looked after the structures. That's why. Do you think when Australia wins gold medals or important things, like we get enough wheat in to feed people this year, do we go, oh God, thank you? Or, oh God, why are you blessing a selfish country like Australia? No, no, a completely godless paper like the Telegraph will raise the God question when people... We've got this view that God's job is to protect us from all sorts of stuff. We ignore him, he protects us. That's not how it works. So I know that I will go through other valleys of the shadow of death. And eventually I'll die. Probably unpleasantly. Most death is fairly unpleasant, right? And that's just part of the human experience. But I know in the end, exactly what it says here, I'll fear no evil. God will be with me in the process. And I'll be we don't have time to look at that. I will be learning good and important things through that whole experience. Any other question before I finish? I've got time to finish with the story, Ken, or should I just be quiet? The secret of peace is not getting such a bank account, such insurance, such a safe house with so many castles, etc., that you can't be hurt, because you can be. Now, all those pictures of peace are illusory. The secret is having is being in this relationship with a God who made all things and is powerful, makes promises and bothers to keep them. In the 19th century, let your imagination run wild. In the 19th century, they didn't have television or anything like that. So what the middle class would do in England, and the upper middle class, would be that they often had what they called a drawing room, where after you'd had a dinner party, people would go to the withdrawing, or your family would move in this other room, and then people would show paintings they'd been painting, or recite poetry they'd learnt, or all sorts of other things. And in an event that happened in London, in the middle of the 19th century, there was a group of these upper middle class people gathered around, and they had a few friends for a dinner party, and they were doing the standard thing of reciting bits of poetry. And there was a man there who was a Shakespearean actor. And pressure was put on him to quote some of the great soliloquies from Shakespeare and things like this, which he did. Eventually he was asked to quote from the psalm that everybody in that period in England almost knew off by heart, which is the Lord is my shepherd, Psalm 23. So he quoted the psalm absolutely beautifully and perfectly, with all the right pauses, etc. And when he finished that, unlike his bits of Shakespeare, everyone in the room just let out a little applause. Well, then they began to pressure the local Anglican minister, the local vicar, who was not a Shakespearean actor, did not have a magnificent voice, but did know the psalm. And in the end, they pressured him. He kept saying, no. Who wants to do that just after the Shakespearean actor has read it? In the end, they pressured him, and he gave in. And he quoted the psalm from memory. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. And I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. He goes through the whole psalm. At the end, the people who were there reported that quite a few of the people, men, women, included, were teary, very deeply moved by it. And there was a sort of an awkward pause in the drawing room. Then the Shakespearean actor stepped into the middle of the room and said, would you like to me to explain to you why, when I quoted the psalm, you clapped, and when the vicar quoted the psalm, you wept? He said, I know the psalm. He knows the shepherd. And that is the key. It's not just knowing some ideas. It's actually having entered that relationship where you can say, I know the shepherd. I don't understand why the shepherd is leading me this way and not that way where I want to go. I don't really understand why I can't stay in this green field long enough, but I trust the shepherd who has died for me. And that's the secret to peace. It's to know the shepherd.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.